From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, pure pop for now people with Nick Lowe. He helped launch the British pub rock movement, produced records by Elvis Costello and the Pretenders, co-founded Rockpile, and recorded solo. Also today, David Douglas Duncan on the republication of his photographs of the Korean War, pictures that tell the story of war by the look in a man's eyes as he takes his last puff on perhaps his last cigarette. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new albums by big bands led by Muhal Richard Abrams and Walter Thompson. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season of public television's American Masters series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Sources at NATO headquarters in Brussels said today that President Bush has made a package of proposals that could make radical changes in the shape of the Western alliance. The proposals are to be presented for discussion at the London summit of NATO's 16 leaders on Thursday and Friday. In a letter to the NATO leaders last week, President Bush proposed a significant rewording of nuclear doctrine and an offer to withdraw all U.S. nuclear artillery shells from Europe. The president also proposed that Soviet and Eastern European diplomats be accredited to NATO headquarters in Brussels. In South Africa, a one-day strike meant to spotlight the problem of factional fighting has been marred by violence. The African National Congress called the strike to force authorities into dealing with black-on-black violence in Natal province. But the strike has brought bombings and death. Independent monitors say 5 people have died, another 20 have been injured. The BBC's Mike Wooldridge has this report from Johannesburg.
Employers' organizations are not disputing the high rate of absenteeism across much of South Africa today. The Western Cape was a notable exception. The strategy of calling the one-day strike, the start of a week of action over Natal, was challenged by the ANC's rival, the Pan-Africanist Congress, which argued that it could intensify a conflict that's already cost at least 2,500 lives. And it was also questioned by a prominent ANC leader in Natal, Mr. Archie Gumede, who said he didn't believe it would make Chief Buthelezi amenable to reason. Dr. Buthelezi, in his statement, accused the ANC and COSATU of bully boy politics aimed at eliminating all opposition to them, saying the strike had left people dead and maimed, homes had been burnt down, wages had been lost.
Mike Wooldridge in Johannesburg. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has just arrived in Britain after a speech in Dublin, Ireland, in which he proposed that the British government should open immediate talks with the Irish Republican Army. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Nelson Mandela provoked a controversy today in Dublin when he called on Britain to hold direct talks with the outlawed Irish Republican Army without any preconditions, such as a ceasefire in IRA violence. Mandela, speaking to the Irish press, said Britain had done the same thing with rebels in Rhodesia and should not make exceptions in the IRA's case. Mandela's comments were seen as a small psychological boost to the IRA, but were downplayed by Irish officials who said visitors have misunderstood the IRA threat before. Nevertheless, by not condemning the IRA, as Britain had urged him to do, Nelson Mandela faces a potentially acrimonious meeting with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in London on Wednesday. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
The Dow Industrials closed at 2,899.26, a gain of almost 19 points today. Advances edged declines in light trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 130 million shares. This is NPR News. The United States Customs Commissioner showed off more than $18 million in confiscated cash today, part of the largest seizure in the agency's history. Commissioner Carol Hallett displayed the money today in Miami, about 60 feet of tables lined with stacks of currency as much as a yard high. She said about $22 million in cash was collected from drug dealers who thought they were laundering the money. Hallett declined to give many details of the sting operation, saying only that it involved a drug ring consisting of Colombians and Cuban Americans working out of Miami. NASA officials outlined their efforts today to solve a mysterious fuel leak plaguing the space shuttles and to correct the blurred vision of the Hubble Space Telescope. They also argued that the recent problems do not mean the space agency is unable to handle its job. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
NASA tried to put on a happy face today after last week's run of troubles. Officials said four troubleshooting teams are starting work to find the fuel leak that has grounded the space shuttle fleet, and a review board is ready to investigate why the Hubble Space Telescope was launched with a serious flaw in its mirrors. NASA chief scientist Leonard Fisk even said there's a good chance engineers will be able to clean up Hubble's blurry pictures through computer processing on the ground, even before NASA sends a repair mission to the space telescope several years from now. But there was a defensive tone at today's press conference, as officials repeated that NASA does not skimp on quality. Clearly, officials are worried about NASA's image, and Administrator Richard Truly made a plea that Congress maintain NASA's budget for major new initiatives like the space station Freedom and manned exploration of Mars. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
On the first day of economic union with West Germany, East Germany called for the elections that will achieve political unity. An East German parliamentary spokesman said today that all German elections should be held on December 2nd. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the British songwriter, singer, bassist, and record producer Nick Lowe. In the 1970s, he helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American top 20. He recorded several solo albums in the 70s and 80s. His new record, Party of One, is his first in a couple of years. It was produced by guitarist Dave Edmonds, who used to play with Lowe in the band Rockpile. From Party of One, this is Nick Lowe's song, All Men Are Liars. Nicola, welcome to Fresh Air. All Men Are Liars, your new song. I have to compliment you on the line, do you remember Rick Astley? He had a big fat hit, it was ghastly. Was this a rhyme that you had been waiting to use for a long time?
Years and years. No, it just presented itself. You know, the song, is, you know, All Men Are Liars. I was really having a pop at that... A crappy old record that he had out, you know, that's never gonna let you down, never gonna tell a lie, never gonna be horrible, never gonna do anything revolting at all. And I thought that was really some poor stuff, you know. So I wasn't really having a go at Rick, I was having a go at his song, but it seems to work well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Astley and Ghastly, yeah.
Very good. You in the early 70s played with Brinsley Schwartz, the British band, and you were one of the first groups to actually play the pubs, and this was like considered the roots of pub rock. Can you explain to Americans why it was such a big deal to be playing in pubs?
God, what a great question. You know, that's a really great question, because it's darn near impossible to explain why it was such a big deal. At that time, in England, England's a tiny place, you know, as anyone who goes there will testify. So everybody knows everybody else, you know, especially in the music business. And at that time, the big thing was glam rock then, which nobody who liked music, really cared for. It's just a fashion thing. That's all England's contribution to the music scene has been for the last, 20 years or so. But the pub rock thing was started. It's just playing, getting back to basics and playing in bars so anyone could just walk in and get a bit of excitement going. But it's you know, you see it happening all the time in America, but in England it's kind of rare, you know. So that's why it's such a big deal, and so difficult to explain what it, you know, to Americans why it was.
You were also the house producer for Stiff Records, which in the 1970s was one of the first real new wave labels. You produced Elvis Costello's first records. You produced Graham Parker's first record. I'm trying to figure out what my question is here. What was your approach to producing? And I'm wondering if you felt that this was the start of something new, or if it just seemed like you know, business as usual to you.
Oh no! I was very reluctantly thrown into that, really. The only reason I got into producing was because of the three of us who started Stiff Records, which is myself, my manager, Jake Riviera, and his pal, Dave Robinson. I spent more time in the studio than the other two guys had, so I was automatically the house producer. I didn't really want the job, but that was, you know, I was designated that. But in fact, and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, at all. And in a way, that was why it worked, because the people that Stiff signed were all kind of oddballs, you know. So the fact that I didn't know what I was doing sort of only added added to the odd sound of those records. And I still don't, you know, I still don't know how to work the equipment or anything like that. But what I do is sort of wave my arms around you know, and tell a couple of jokes and things, and watch them do it, you know, and if with the engineers, if I get an engineer that I can talk to, you know, I don't say to him, hey man, put a bit of 3.4 on channel 26, you know, I don't know anything like about that. I'll go more sort of, can you make it go a bit more because it's just going zzz at the moment, or you know, I go, can you make it go jang, or can you make the drum go boing? Or, you know, I make noises like that, and if they're cool, they know what I'm talking about. If they don't, then we're not going to get very far.
I think this has been taken as your credo, but you once said that your approach to producing was bash it out now, tart it up later.
Yes. Well, I mean, you can't do that nowadays, you know. I mean, the same principle applies. You know, I think the same principle still holds good. You know, that you shouldn't worry too much about it. It'll take care of itself, you know. But you know, you hear so many records nowadays that are, you know, as soon as they start, that you're not going to hear a single mistake on there. You know, there's going to be no human hand is going to be visible at all. Like no humans had anything to do with it. And the vocal, you can tell nobody can sing like that, like they do on records. You know, that's done line by word by word. In a painstaking and agonizing process. Now, I don't think that this business is that important, you know, to warrant spending the amount of money that a family of four could live on comfortably for a year, you know, in some Ponzi studio making some piece of old claptrap. I just don't see that it's that important. And when it's such poor stuff, you know, it's very, very poor. Most records, I think, I last about 4 minutes listening to the radio nowadays. I think it's rubbish, mostly.
Well, a lot of records really have become a producer's medium, and you start to feel like the singers are really interchangeable.
Yeah,
you know, like any
producers,
voice will do, you just plug in someone onto the voice track.
Well, they're not really producers, these people. You know, I don't think. They don't know anything about music. They're engineers who've learned how to type, basically, and they can type out stuff. They can probably rip you off a couple of faxes at the same time as they're doing the drum machine, you know. And that stuff just doesn't excite me at all. In fact, I don't dislike it. You know, it's I don't think anything about it. It just goes in one ear, and immediately out of the other.
Well, I want to ask you about songwriting, but first, let me reintroduce you. My guest is songwriter, bass player, singer, producer Nick Lowe, and he has a new record out called Party of One. Now, I want to play one of your songs that it's a great song. It's What's So Funny About Peace and Peace, Love and Understanding. I'd like to hear the story behind the song, if there is one, and how ironic or how serious you were about the meaning of the lyrics.
Let me see. I thought this song up in about 1973. It's quite an old song, and when I did it as a joke, really. It's so sort of pretentious, you know. I did it on purpose. This sort of as I walk this wicked world, searching, you know, for this and that and the other. I thought it was kind of funny, you know, and then finish off with what's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding is the hook. And it was okay, you know, it was pretty good. And but then Elvis Costello started doing it in, I don't know, the late 70s or early 80s. And he started doing it in his show, and he still does it. And I don't know, he put something into the words, into the performance of it, that made the words, even though I meant them as a joke, you know, it made them mean something, you know. And the song's sort of, I've changed my mind about the song. I think it's really pretty good now.
So do you sing it more seriously now when you do it yourself?
I think so, yeah. I think I do too, yeah. Maybe because I'm older or something like that, you know. I don't feel quite that it's quite such a joke or something, you know. But it's still it's still not as good as Jailhouse Rock.
Well, let's hear Nick Lowe's recording of What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Nick Lowe recorded in 1974 with the band Brinsley Schwartz. How did you start writing songs?
When I started, which was when I left home with a guitar case in my hand, Lord, which was in 1968, you had to write your own songs. That was the thing to do. You know, every group. You wouldn't get anywhere unless you had somebody in the group who could write their own songs.
This is the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a lot of really crappy songs about. And I was sort of designated the songwriter of the group. And my initial efforts, you know, it takes a while for you to find your own style. So my initial efforts were really derivative. You know, I mean, I really can't listen to the first records that I did. I don't really listen to my own records at all much, really, but the first ones I definitely can't, because I can hear really obviously where I was getting my influence from. You know, I used to like The Band very much, and I rewrote their catalogue, you know, several times. The night they drove old Pixie down. you know, very, very obviously. But then, you see, well, in the case of The Band, and I'd read an article about them, and they'd say that they liked Lee Dorsey, for instance, and I'd go, Lee Dorsey, oh, I know him. He did Working in a Coal Mine and Ride Your Pony from the 60s. Right, I'll check him out again. And I'd go and buy a Lee Dorsey album, you know, and think, yeah, this is great. Oh, I can hear how they got that idea and this idea from Lee Dorsey. And then I'd look and see, oh, it's produced by Alan Toussaint. And then I'd find another record, you know, Ernie K. Doe or someone like that, produced by Alan Toussaint. And then it'd be the Meters, and then the Neville Brothers, you know, and slowly you start hearing all this other stuff, and you get and your influences get more and more, not quite as refined, you know, more and more obscure, I suppose, if you like, and if you like that stuff, then you'll find your own style inside you. The main thing is that you've got to accept what you are. When you start off, you have this preconceived idea of what you are. You know, I mean, I thought I was this sort of bad dude from, you know, from the swamps, you know. Which I'm patently, I'm not, you know, I'm a white middle-class English kid, you know, or was a kid, you know, but, and once you accept that, then you can get on with it, you know, once you accept what you are, then you get your own style going, and you can relax about it.
When you started, as you say, accepting who you were, did the kinds of songs you were writing change?
No, I don't think so. I've been singing the same song basically since I started. You know, when I was a real kid, the nearest you could get to rock and roll on Forces Radio, because my dad was in the Royal Air Force, and so I lived wherever he was stationed. You know, which is mainly in the Middle East. And so I used to listen to Forces Radio, and at that time in the '50s, you know, it was very, very, you know, it was all Rosemary Clooney and Perry Como and that, yes. Which, as a matter of fact, the first record I bought was Magic Moments by Perry Como. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Still do, as a matter of fact. I still think that's wild. But the nearest you could get to any kind of rock and roll stuff was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan. And he used to do... he had this sound, he's called his skiffle sound, which was, heavy acoustic, just thumping acoustic guitars and a real simple bass and drum line. And washboards, he plays washboard thing, you know.
Now I think there's a couple of hits Americans would remember, like Did Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight? Did they do Rock Island Line too?
That's right, you got it. Yeah, Rock Island Line, Cumberland Gap. He used to do a lot of sort of big Bill Brunsey things and Ledbetter songs. I learned all his stuff, and I still really, that's still the same sort of thing I do now, really.
I have always wondered why so many British rockers have been so influenced by Lonnie Donegan, because the records by him I know are Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight, which I think is really just an atrocious record.
Yeah, yes, that was a bit later on. Extremely amusing to English people, but totally. Was that a hit over here, really?
Yeah.
Good grief. No, that was awful. But his early stuff was really great.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is songwriter, singer, bassist, record producer, Nick Lowe, and he has a new record out called Party of One. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Nick Lowe is my guest. You know how you said that you're still writing the same song and these are mm-hmm. songs influenced by the Lonnie Donegan days?
Yeah.
Choose a song on the new record that you think is obviously influenced by that.
By Lonnie Donegan?
By the early stuff that you're listening to there.
Oh, I think most of it is actually on the new record, but an obvious example would be Who Was That Man?
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what song I hear in that?
What?
You know Children Go Where I Send Thee? Do you know?
Wait a minute, I think I do, yeah. It's a sort of a spiritual thing,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. That's quite unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Quite unconscious, but great.
Okay.
That's not a bad place to get something from.
So let's listen to Who Was That Man from your new record, Party of One.
Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody knows all across this land. Was that an unknown man? Who was that? Who was that man? It was a wild and wet November night, and the rush hour was at its height. Kings crossed the venue that the finger of death was pointed at. Among the crowd was a lonely soul with a mission in mind and a place to go. Nobody knows where he was bound when his fateful steps took him underground. Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody loved him all across this land. Was that an unloved man? Who was that? Who was that man? Through the open gates.
Is this record more of a return to folk in your musical background than previous records have been?
I don't think so. I think doing touring with Elvis Costello, mm-hmm. he encouraged me to go on tour with him playing acoustically, you know. And I didn't think I could do it, but he really kind of bullied me into it, you know. And I'm really glad he did, because if you stand up on the stage with an acoustic guitar in front of a few people, you soon can tell, you know, if your stuff is happening or not. And it put me back in touch with my own songwriting thing, which I'd lost sight of a little bit. And if folk music means something that you can just rip off on a guitar, then yes. But the thing is that I was listening to some of my old records to try and get an act together, you know, trying to think, well, which one shall I do in this act? I had to relearn them again. You know, I couldn't remember how they went. I found that some of the best records I'd made were some of the worst songs, like I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, for instance, is a record of nothing very much. It's a good record, but there's nothing very much there in a song wise, you know. Whereas a song like Raining, I listened to that and went, oh man, you just recorded this all wrong. You know, the song isn't there. You know, the way it's been recorded. In other words, you can record a song or make a record. Do you see that there's a subtle difference there?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of records that are really great records because of the way they're produced, because of the way the singer sounds, but the song is pretty insubstantial. It's not one you'd want to pick out yourself. Yeah.
Like Let Me Take You to Funky Town by Lip Sync. You know, that was a really great record, that was, but there's not very much
right.
of a song there.
Right. One of your American releases has a great title, A Pure Pop for Now People. And what is the meaning of pop to you? How has that word changed to you over the years?
Well, popular music is stuff that sells, you know, which patently mine doesn't. You know, the stuff I do is still kind of a secret in the great scheme of things. But the stuff I suppose what I'm known for being a sort of pop guy is because I'm a fan, you know, really, and I sort of imitate the. Or at that time, anyway, I was sort of imitating what people's perception of pop music was, which is like, you know, real throwaway fluff, you know, just rejoicing in its disposability, you know. It always reminds me of sort of like cornflakes ads, you know, jingles on the TV, you know, real disposable stuff. And I like that.
Nick Lowe, his latest album is Party of One. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Christopher Lee, the British actor many people think was the definitive Dracula. He also played Frankenstein's monster and the mummy, and he's now appearing in Gremlins 2. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Big bands are often considered to represent the tamer, more traditional end of jazz. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new albums from two bands that challenge that preconception. Also today, This Is War. 40 years ago, when the Korean War began, photojournalist David Douglas Duncan set out to show how men live and die when they know death is among them. His book, This Is War, has just been republished. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new season of American Masters, Public TV's documentary series on the men and women who have shaped American art and culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush met today at his home in Maine with top Bush administration officials. The meeting was to get ready for the NATO summit meeting later on this week in London. The president said that the NATO alliance will be undergoing some changes in the future, although not of what he termed bombshell dimensions. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president has reportedly proposed a set of changes for the 16 leaders attending the NATO summit to consider. Foremost is a plan that nuclear arms be made the alliance's weapons of last resort. That is a significant change from the current alliance policy of flexible response, which can mean early use of nuclear weapons to counter a conventional attack. Mr. Bush has also reportedly offered to withdraw U.S. nuclear-tipped artillery shells from Western Europe, most of which are in West Germany and have become irrelevant as East and West Germany become one. With the Warsaw Pact all but disbanded and the two Germanys well down the road to unification, the main challenge facing the NATO ministers later this week may be redefining the alliance's mission in a changed world. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Nelson Mandela, speaking before a joint session of the Irish Parliament, said again today that promises of change in South Africa should not bring an end to economic sanctions because the apartheid system continues. He also urged Great Britain to follow the example of the South African government, of President F.W. de Klerk, and not require a ceasefire before talking to an armed foe, in this case, the IRA. Mandela flew to Britain tonight from Dublin. Soviet leader Gorbachev opened a Congress of his divided Communist Party today with a call for unity in the face of new political competition in the Soviet Union. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
In his 2.5-hour speech, Gorbachev defended his domestic and foreign policies, now under fire from both right and left within his party. He dismissed conservative charges that his program of perestroika is to blame for all of the country's failures. That, said Gorbachev, is simply rubbish. At the same time, Gorbachev pleaded with liberals to remain within the party. If the Communist Party splits, he said, perestroika will be defeated. But the Soviet leader dismissed a liberal proposal to remove party control from institutions such as the KGB and the Soviet courts. The 4,700 Congress delegates are scheduled to meet for 10 days. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
A 3-day strike by air traffic controllers in France is scheduled to get underway tomorrow, and officials expect it to cause widespread disruptions, especially for domestic flights. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 18.5 points to close at 2,899.26. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a tale of two big bands. Both are based in New York, but rarely make public appearances. They have no personnel in common, and their players mostly travel in different circles. But Kevin says that musically, they have a few things in common. Both help chart new directions for the jazz orchestra.
Composer and pianist Muhal Richard Abrams helped found the most important organization in modern jazz, Chicago's AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. It cropped up in the 1960s when the jazz world was badly fragmented. But members of the AACM, like Anthony Braxton, the Yard Ensemble of Chicago, and Mujal himself, wanted to avail themselves of everything jazz had to offer, from noisy, free improvising to elaborate compositions. Of all these musicians, Mujal is the one whose primary instrument is the orchestra, the one who has the most colors to paint with. He has a new album out on the Black Saint label called The Herenga Suite. Mujal is what some folks call a restructuralist. He takes musical elements that are already out there and recombines them in fresh ways. Quote-unquote, postmodern musicians get off on abruptly jumping from one style to another. But restructuralists want to unite diverse elements, so one flows smoothly into the next. I know I'm making this sound complicated, but it's not hard to hear. Listen to how many episodes Mujal squeezes into 40 seconds of one piece. Those off-center rhythms and slinky Ellington saxes are a couple of Mujal's favorite devices. It takes a real gift to make them fit together. In jazz these days, when players talk about honoring the tradition, their definition of what that means is usually pretty narrow. To most of them, tradition means bebop. But Mujal Richard Abrams embraces all aspects of jazz, from the difficult to the mainstream. The Herenga Suite includes, among other things, passages that blur the line between electronic and acoustic music. But it also contains some plain old straight-ahead swing. Mujal Richard Abrams isn't too well known among mainstream jazz fans, but his ideals percolate through other folks' music. Composer and saxophonist Walter Thompson runs a big band that sounds directly influenced by Mujal. Thompson's new CD is called Not for Rollo. It's on the Atava label. Thompson's music resembles Mujal's most obviously in its angularity, but it also has some of the same rapid transitions. Critics love to chart lines of influence, but things aren't always as they appear. Walter Thompson says he never heard Mujal's orchestra until after he recorded his own big band album. His first inspiration was Charles Ives, but he did study in the 70s with Mujal's friend Anthony Braxton. As Thompson says, The resemblance between Muhal's music and his own shows you can be influenced by the artistic climate of your time as much as by specific people. Walter Thompson's mastery of color and form isn't on a par with Muhal's, but he does have the same sort of artistic ambition. He doesn't lead the music down a safe and narrow path.
Given Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Years ago, David Douglas Duncan was one of the first photographers on the scene in the Korean War. He hoped that one day his pictures would be viewed as photographic headstones for the men who fought and died in Korea. To commemorate the 40th anniversary of the war, Little Brown has brought out a new edition of his book, This Is War. Many of the pictures were initially published in Life magazine. Duncan is also well known for the thousands of pictures he took of Pablo Picasso during the last 17 years of the artist's life. This Is War describes what war is like by focusing on the expression on men's faces, or as Duncan put it, the look in the man's eyes who is taking his last puff on perhaps his last cigarette before he grabs his rifle and attacks an enemy position.
When I went to Korea, it was 5 years after the end of World War II, and I'd been a Marine combat photographer in the fight up through the islands up to Tokyo Bay, the surrender on board the Missouri. So I had a pretty fair idea of what combat was all about. And I'd been back in Japan for Life magazine doing a story on Japanese art, theater, architecture, everything. And the Korean War started on the 25th of June. Since I was the nearest Life photographer, it was logical I should go there. But the lucky thing was my experience. So that when I started to shoot, I started from a running start. I didn't have to be indoctrinated. I knew what I was looking at. And I knew what I'd felt during World War II, so I tried to translate that feeling into photographs that would reveal some of the feelings of the men in front of me. And I always photographed Marines. I knew what they would do if I got hit. They'd get me out of there. So I was very much at home. It was a home environment. It seems strange you could say a home environment in combat, but very much a home environment.
So many of the pictures in your book are like portraits of men in war and close-ups of their faces. And I was wondering how you got that close to the men, if they were aware that you were taking their photographs.
No. Under those circumstances, and I'm saying it sounds awkward to say it, but it's a fact, they were usually under combat conditions. And the thing of least concern in the other man, the trooper, the Marine, it's what the fellow's doing next to him, unless he has a weapon and a camera. Had no meaning whatsoever. And remember, I was also older than the guys in Korea, and then much older by the time Vietnam came around. So, and they knew who I was. That's the having survived other situations like that. That I was well known on the battlefield. So there was no. I was just another Marine. So there was no barrier between what they were doing and how they were working. Remember, these are men at work. They were mostly professional Marines, very few draftees. This was their job. And I was doing my job while they did their job. As simple as that.
Is there a photo from your Korean War series that still has the most emotional impact on you when you look at it?
You know, once I asked Pablo Picasso, whom I'd photographed many, many times and made several books on him, what was his favorite painting? And he shoved his hand up in front of my eyes and says, which is my favorite finger? It's all a part of him. So these photographs are all a part of me. I can't say that one's more of a favorite than another, because each one relates to another kind of memory, another kind of man. Very few of these men in the book survived, so that you're dealing with many emotions within me. And I tried to simplify that when I shot it, just what did he look like, what did he feel, and as I said some other place, I didn't know anything about what he was thinking, but I knew what I was thinking. So I try to make, I'm very subjective as a war photographer. I want to break your heart.
I want to mention some of the photographs that I found just especially moving. One is a sequence of portraits of a Marine who, in the first portrait, there's a...
Leonard Hayworth. He's in the foreground, and an old Marine in the background, talking him out of it, out of his crack up. There are four shots on the double page.
Yeah, actually, that's it.
That's what I'm looking for. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's, if you look at it very closely, you'll see something quite surprising, that the only movement in that picture is in the change of expression in Hayward's face, the guy in front of me, the Marine, who had come back from the front line, which was about 25 feet away, actually, trying to get more ammunition or a replacement for some of the men who had been wounded. A couple had been killed. There was nothing. It was raining. Nothing. And he cracked up, really cracked up. And the old Marine saw him. He'd been wounded. He sat there and forgot his own wounds and talked Leonard out of it. He came from a lovely place called Deer Path, Indiana. Can you imagine? He was killed about 3 weeks later.
Another photograph I want to ask you about. This is toward the end of the book, in a sequence of photographs of the Marines on retreat. There's a soldier...
Wait a minute. They didn't retreat. They're coming down from the reservoir that's on the border of Manchuria and North Korea. And when you retreat from an enemy force of greater strength which is in front of you. You put them behind you and take off. It happens to be that there were more Chinese communist troopers in front of those Marines than behind them. They fought their way through. They didn't retreat. They fought their way out.
Yeah. Well, in the photograph I'm thinking of, there's a soldier sitting on the hood of a Jeep. There's a rifle on his lap. And the expression on his face, I think, will always stay with me. It looks like, well, it kind of looks like he looked into hell, and it left him numb.
He was wounded and frozen and riding, because the only way to get him out, if you come out ambulatory, you've tied up a couple of guys, but at least there was still a Jeep running, so he got on the hood of the Jeep. But if you looked to your left, the viewer's left in that photograph, you'll see another Marine who was ambulatory, also wounded, and looking at him with sheer hatred. Can you imagine hating your friend? Because it's an animal factor of survival. It just happens. And the photograph, I think, nailed it down pretty well. But 5 minutes later, it might have changed completely. But that moment, the freezing walking Marine would like to have had a lift on the hood of the Jeep carrying out his friend.
How cold was it?
In the terms of a thermometer, it was about 40 below zero Fahrenheit. And in those days, that's 40 years ago, we didn't know about chill factor, but the wind was coming out of Siberia at about anywhere from 25 to 50 miles an hour. So I would imagine the chill factor was somewhere between 60 and 80 degrees below. You know, sometimes it comes back, I can't think about it, because I think the guy's freezing below zero Fahrenheit. It's really strange. It comes back and grabs you by the throat, and I'm sitting here fiddling with a paperclip on top of your table in the studio, and I think about those guys of another life.
Dude, have people ever told you that they recognized a husband or a boyfriend?
I'm still getting letters 40 years later from one of those freezing Marines, and everybody from Army, Navy, Air Force, other Marines. I don't know exactly who he was. I know where he was. I know the day. It was taken the 9th of December, just at dawn, on the just below the Yalu River. I know what the temperature was. I know many things, but I don't know. I didn't ask his name. But I was on a program a few days ago, and a call came in from Florida, and a woman was sure it was her husband, except I was sure that it wasn't, because the lady calling identified her husband as having been in the Army. This guy was a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. But let me make one point.
Yeah.
Except for the rare case where it doesn't seem to be injurious, I don't tell them. I let them think it's there. their husband or brother, father. No, can you imagine? That's 40 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a call from a lady. I live in the south of France. I got a call a couple of months ago at midnight. She didn't realize how late it was where I live. And she was identifying her father, who was a Marine, and he'd gotten the Medal of Honor, the highest decoration given by the military. But he was killed 3 days before I made that picture. So I told her, so she would never be shattered when she discovered that I'd been kidding her. So I didn't deceive her. The others I'm not deceiving. I just don't disillusion them.
What are the secrets of shooting in combat without becoming a target yourself?
Well, you are a target, of course. It's a lodger. You know, I'm just lucky. In fact, there's a shot there of Ike Fenton. Ike's a guy with the 1,000-yard stare looking over my shoulder. Ike Fenton, the captain of the assault company up in the beginning. I tied up with him about a month later during the attack into Seoul, the second chapter of the book. And it had been a terrible night and very cold, strange enough, for September. And I thought, shallow foxhole, a lot of stuff coming in, stuff being, that is, rifle fire, a little bit of machine gun, and mortar. So you just try to stay as low as you can, very low profile. If you roll over, you might catch it in your shoulder. There's that shallow a foxhole. And it slacked off at dawn, a beautiful dawn, cold, and I stood up to stretch, and I thought I'd pulled a chest muscle. And I started to laugh and reached down and held his hand. I held up my fist, and he handled a 30 caliber machine gun slug. This hit me in the chest. At the end of its flight, my dear, as far as it would go, and it hit me, and it dropped without even denting me, nothing. So you say, sometimes you're hit, it doesn't make a difference. Other times you get hit, and it does make a big difference. But I've been lucky. I've just been nicked lightly. I've never been really hit. But the other guys around me, sure.
Do you see these photographs as anti-war photos?
You better believe it. That's why I so object to a politician calling these guys boys. Can you imagine? Some boys.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your hospitality.
Photographer David Douglas Duncan. A new edition of his 1951 book, This Is War, has just been published by Little Brown and Company. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We're going to be hearing from Moscow today about the beginning of the Communist Party Congress, where Mikhail Gorbachev rebutted his critics, and they are both hardliners who say he should stop perestroika and radical reformers who say he should begin already. We'll also be hearing from East Berlin and our correspondent Mike Schuster, where the first weekend of the Deutschmark, as being the currency, has gone very, very smoothly, and where you can now cross back and forth throughout the city without waiting for your papers to be inspected, and also the first part of a two-part series by Wendy Schmelzer on wife abuse.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week on Public TV, the documentary series American Masters begins its fifth season of profiles about people in the arts. TV critic David Bianculli has this review of the series' opener on the life and career of Preston Sturges.
His name was Preston Sturges. Starting as a Broadway playwright, he opened the gates for generations of future filmmakers by becoming the first screenwriter to successfully establish himself as a film director. In the process, he made himself one of the most celebrated figures of the 1940s. But his star, which had burned so brightly, fell almost as quickly as it had risen. To this day, the man who introduced irony to American screen comedy remains an enigmatic and contradictory personality.
Producer-director Kenneth Bowser has given this American Masters installment a long but accurate title, Preston Sturges, The Rise and Fall of an American Dreamer. Sturges had a career as a Broadway and Hollywood writer-director that was absolutely outrageous, and this delightful documentary captures it all. His mother, who shuttled young Preston between Chicago and Europe, was a constant companion of Isadora Duncan, and Preston's family had just enough money so that he didn't have to worry about holding a real job. At age 29, he happened to read a book called A Study of the Drama and decided to write some plays. His second effort, Strictly Dishonorable, was written in 6 days. Sturgis financed a low-budget Broadway production of it, and it became the biggest comedy hit of the 1929 season. Before long, he moved to Hollywood and hit gold there, too. But he didn't like the way directors were filming his scripts. So in 1939, when he was earning $2,500 a week as a screenwriter, he sold a movie script called The Great McGinty to Paramount Pictures for $1, on the condition that he be allowed to direct it. That unprecedented deal led to some great films, including 1942's Sullivan's Travels, a semi-autobiographical satire in which Sturgis cast Joel McRae as an ambitious writer-director. Sullivan wants to make the great American movie, but the studio executives he shows it to want him to make it a little more commercial.
You see the symbolism of it? Capital and labor destroy each other. It teaches a lesson, a moral lesson. It has social significance.
Who wants to see that kind of stuff? It gives me the creeps.
Tell them how long it played at the music hall.
It was held over a fifth week.
Who goes to the music hall? Communists.
Communists? This picture's an answer to communists. It shows we're awake and not dunking our heads in the sand like a bunch of ostriches. I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realism, the problems that confront the average man.
But with a little sex in it.
With a little sex in it.
Not only is Sullivan's Travels a funny movie, but it's hilarious to see how little things in Hollywood have changed. There's less humor, though, in what happens to Sturgis next, but you can watch American Masters and see that for yourself. Then, when it's over, you can do what I did and go to your local video store to discover or rediscover Sturgis's films, starting maybe with Sullivan's Travels and The Lady Eve. When it's this good, American Masters can get you excited about the artists it profiles, and that's why I get so excited about American Masters. Coming up in the next few weeks, programs on John Cassavetes, Martin Scorsese, and Edward R. Murrow.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, horror movie star Christopher Lee on playing Dracula and Frankenstein. Also, we meet one of the few cellists in jazz, Deirdre Murray. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.